is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Alex Romaine. He is a electronic musician. He operates Urban Sunrise Records and is best known for coming out with the release of the first drum bass record ever. Alex, great talking to you.
Robert, likewise, thank you. How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, I'm doing excellent, and I'm also joined here with my co-host, Apilator.
It's nice talking to you. I actually found out about that, too. A friend showed me this one record by, I think it's Apache or something. It's on YouTube, and it claims to be the world's first drum and bass record ever.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the first non-compilation album, it was the first, as far as we were aware, it's the first album that was actually constructed by a unit as in a group or guys working together that wasn't actually a DJ mixtape or a compilation or anything like that, or just another mix album. So as far as we were, it was the first actual album of its kind. And also, I think what we were trying to do was represent that specific era, which was like a crossover era between sort of hardcore and where it moved into what became jungle, sort of between 1991 and 92.
When was your album released?
It was released some way through 92, middle of 92. Yeah, it came out initially. It was just in Bristol in the southwest because we only released it. It's a limited run.
Briefly lived in the southwest.
Oh, did you live whereabouts?
Plymouth.
Plymouth. Yeah, I think there's some guys that moved into Bristol around 94 that come from around there. I think they may have been part of Represent, Ronnie Size's outfit in Bristol, Full Circle. Yeah. So there's connection that I know about approximately between Plymouth and Bristol around that time, but not too much. I'd moved back to, I moved to Birmingham by then. So, yeah.
How did you first originally get into music, and what were your earliest inspirations?
Right. Well, I think my mother was, and my father were both musicians in their own right. They were both pianists, guitarists, and I think my mother, not necessarily my father, my mother was classically trained pianist. So I grew up as a kid, whether I liked it or not, with my mother and playing guitar, piano. Most of it was folk orientated, sort of slash blues and just pretty much anything. Jams, a lot of jamming, a lot of folk heads getting together and drinking and just sticking their guitars and pianos together and doing stuff in houses. It was like a folk underground, really. Nothing connected too much to what I do today. But also she was deeply into classical music. So I remember my earliest memories of music was actually trying to sleep, listening to Bach, Four Seasons particularly a lot as a child and trying to actually sleep against it and things like that. So it was mostly classical and sort of folk during the early childhood. And I was also separately, I was fascinated with the record deck. I was fascinated with this thing that you put on, this thing that goes round and out comes all this sound, and I couldn't leave it all alone. And separately, my father as well. Even though they divorced when I was very young, I was only one, so I didn't get to meet him until in later life, which was very unusual because I think I was 15 when I discovered that he was also a music producer. So we'd had no contact throughout our entire lives, and the first time I sort of get to know anything about him when I'm 15 is to discover that he became a music producer in his own right and a pianist, and played a very specific type of music, 3.5/4 and things like this. A Celtic, a very unusual form of Celtic folk, underground Celtic folk that's got some kind of Arabic link, is the sort of stuff he was working on. And he was flying out to Iraq during the embargo and everything and recording music from Iraqi artists. And
was this
getting it
in the early 90s after the Gulf War?
Yeah, he was in Iraq then, and he was actually there after the West imposed the embargoes on Iraq. He went out there and recorded musicians from Iraqi musicians, recorded their music, and he uploaded it to his own server while he was in Iraq, and then would come back to Scotland and download it. So that's how you'd get it past customs. It's basically by using the web. So he was sort of showing me things like this. We hooked up a couple of times and we experimented. But I think the influence directly was from my mother. But I think genetically, there's something there from my father, because I don't think it's a coincidence that we both ended up as musicians, both ended up producers before we ever met. So, yeah.
Were you influenced by the 80s electronica music?
Yeah, I was, massively and shamefully. Some of the pop, like, at the time, and I don't know what happened here, but I can remember not being able to stand Duran Duran and Wham and all of these British, Spandau Ballet and all these kind of, these new wave, bands in the early 80s, pop bands. But Howard Jones, I loved, and that was about it. Pet Shop Boys, a few other things. But as
Howard
I got
Jones,
into the 90s.
I think the only song I can think of is the one, Things Can Only Get Better.
Okay, yeah, I don't know how prolific he is. I know that he's doing holiday camp tours around the UK at the moment, I think, with a load of 80s, other 80s people. But he was very influential for me, Gary Numan, around this time. I wasn't into synth music, even though I loved synthesizers and the synth sound. I found a lot of synth bands and a lot of synth music I didn't actually like. I wasn't too into Kraftwerk and the early pioneers of this music in the 80s and all the rest of it, when I kind of should have been, but I just wasn't. A lot of the stuff from a lot of the bands in the north of England at the time, and Manchester, like New Order, Human League, the synth music they were doing at the time, I just couldn't get my head around. I hate these plinky plonky major key kind of, hey, we've got a synth and that's so you're going to make sure the whole world knows we've got it. I love synths, I love synthesis, I love the process and the principles and the sounds, but I couldn't get into 80s synth music, except for maybe some stuff with Gary Numan. I think maybe a bit before, in the late 70s, Our Friends Electric, Tubeway Army. I think I was 8 years old. I was in the garden digging a hole and eating mud. I used to eat mud. And I remember this came on the radio and it blew me away. And that memory that day, it stayed with me that day. I think I stopped eating mud and turned seriously to music. But that track, Our Friends Electric Gaming New Tubeway Army, it really, really got me. And it was a synth track, but it was dark and it was heavy and it was well-structured and it wasn't silly. It wasn't plinky plonky. It was wholesome. It had depth. And I found that a lot of early 80s synth bands totally lacked depth and soul. And I think maybe it's an excuse to say, oh, well, you know, we're using electronic and process music, it gets clinical. Yeah, sure, it does. But as an engineer and as a writer, you can put soul into anything if you want to.
Yeah, I heard that. I think back in the 80s, that was a kind of complaint, that people who were into the rock music from the 60s and 70s said that 80s synth was too synthetic and lacked soul. But
yeah.
Now people today are saying the opposite, that music had a lot more soul to it than music today. So you always see those trends. You mentioned classical music, and what's interesting is I don't hear this observation a lot, but I see a lot of overlap with classical and synth music because of the amount of complexity. Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, I mean, guitar can be great,
yeah,
but you are limited by the amount of chords you can do. Both classical and synth, there's just unlimited possibilities.
I think what you've just said there is so interesting, and I think it's a very exciting and very unexplored realm of contemporary, particularly dance producers and musicians like myself, because something I was trying to do around 2007, another experimental form I was trying to sort of look at creating, I just called it Tech Beat, was basically to do, it was a perspective on something you've just mentioned, and the idea was to use classical structures, the sort of the actual movements and the complex movements you were talking about, but as a template and to overlay synthesis and to actually put it out through a dance flavor as opposed to Jean-Michel Jarre or anything like that, or anything more ambient. So what I tried to do with Tech Beat was to actually try to bring those aspects you've just mentioned into dance, but I think I got a couple of the aspects wrong. It's generally too fast as a genre. There was a couple of things with it for why it didn't sort of hit or take off. I may revisit it, but I still think it's too early. I think it's too fast for what Tech Beat was trying to do in 2007 for a flat beat. It was just too fast. But I am starting to explore using classical structures in some new drum and bass and things that we're working on at the moment. And I'm trying to do things I was doing more as a teenager, where I was actually writing stories, I suppose, really, with music. And it was all very visual and very graphic. And I'm looking to actually get back into that and to just see if I can to bring those through and actually make it work definitively. Because, of course, when you're messing around with things of this complexity, if it's not definitive and you don't get it right, people can't hear it for what you're trying to get it across. It just all falls apart. People can't identify with it. And they're just like, well, what's that? Which can be great. But, you know, sometimes people need to identify with what they do. You always need to identify with what you're doing, who you are.
Can you talk more about the drum bass? Did you invent it, or you were the one to first use it in an album?
Both. Yeah, I would love to go into that moment. This is a moment that we're actually trying to recreate and capture and put it on video. And over the last few months, we've been sourcing the exact same equipment I used in that era and in that moment. And I actually want to show people visually what I experienced in that moment, because I was on a conscious thing. I was trying to see if it was possible to actually consciously create a genre of music, as opposed to being someone who works, you know, in the progressive edge of music and it just happens to, should we say, evolve into something else. I wanted to see if it could actually be structured. And I also thought, I couldn't think of a more challenging way of pushing myself as a musician, as an engineer, and as a writer, to actually just see if it was possible to actually just try and create a standalone form of music. So what I was doing to do that was, I suppose we are talking about semi-formulation, or at least looking at trying to get something as a formula together to start with. And so what I did was, I heard what was going on at the time, and around this time with hardcore music, it was just starting to speed up. This is around 1990 to mid 91. It was just starting to pick up from 134 on average, 134 BPM, and it was just starting to speed up. And I was noticing at some of the places that I was going to that it was speeding up on almost a weekly basis. So there was some things going on here, some patterns that you could see were happening that you could potentially forecast some aspects from. So for one thing, I saw that things were getting faster. Another thing I saw from the hardcore was that it was getting heavier. And at the time, I was actually working with punk rock bands in London while I was working on my own acid and house and things like that. So I was quite fired up, and there's a very aggressive influence from all of this going on at the same time. And so I saw what was going on with the speed, and I saw that everything was pretty much flat beat at the time. The bass drum was always dum, dum, dum. It didn't matter what genre or subgenre, that was always going on. The punk rock I was working with was really exciting me at the time, and I just wanted to try and inject that into the hardcore that was going on. So I'd already started messing around with some ideas, and I had some offbeat bass and snare drums and raw hi-hats, acoustic, that were mimicking the punk rock bands I was working with. So I was literally imitating these guys into a drum box and using them as an influence and creating my own punk rock bass drum, snare drums and hi-hat rhythms using a drum machine. And I was speeding them up and just playing with it and adding things here and there, and nothing really happened until I decided to do something which I'd been just wanting to do for so long and hadn't been able to get around to it through lack of gear, not the right samples and this and that, which was to actually really go to town on a particular couple of breakbeats. One was a James Brown breakbeat. The drummer was Clive Stubblefield, who's recently passed away. And the track is The Funky Drummer. And I desperately wanted to do something with that. And I had a guitar sampler, a sampler pedal made by Roland, the Boss Range, that one of the punk rock guys had lent me. And I daisy chained all these effects pedals together and had them hanging out of my synths just to use everything I'd had. I always optimized. I'd always been sort of conditioned to make the most out of everything I've got, even if that means stripping it apart and rebuilding it and cannibalizing it. So I've always been that way inclined anyway. So I've got a Roland Juno 2, borrowed a Korg M1. I've got an Alesis drum box. This is around 1991. This is just before it happened. And I've got all of this gear, and I've got a Yamaha VSS sort of 1.5-octave keyboard sampler. And I've got this range of guitar effects pedals. One of these pedals happens to have a sampler section in it. It's the Roland sampler delay pedal DS2. And I literally loaded up the cassette into a cassette deck and direct injected the James Brown funky drummer loop straight into the sampler pedal. And it worked. And when I went to hit the pedal back for the first time to re-trigger whatever I'd captured, the shortness of the memory on the sampler pedal had just absolutely cut out everything that I wanted to capture and to play with. And it literally just captured the first few milliseconds, the first bass drum, I think, and maybe snare drum. So you literally got And that was it. I didn't get my dung dung ding ding dum da ding did it. I didn't get that, which is what I wanted to play around with and chop up. I just got dung dung ding. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm not gonna be going dung dung ding, dung dung ding, dung dung ding on top of anything. And that was what I was trying to get away from, was the flat beat thing, and like I said, all topped up with all this punk rock. So I just started hitting the pedal on an offbeat thing. It was automatic, I didn't even think about it, and it was dung dung ding dung dung ding dung ding dung dung ding dung dung ding dung 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 ding. And that's when I heard what's now become drum and bass, was initially called jungle. I didn't call it anything. To me, it was just progressive hardcore, because anything I was working on was progressive and whatever it was. So this was just more of the same, more of what I've been doing since I was 13, 14, 15. But thanks to the terrible memory, the short memory on the sampler pedal, I had no choice. The sampler pedal restricted what I wanted to do in that moment. But in that moment, and seeing that that was all I had, what can I do? I'd already had a bass sound loaded into my only other sampler. So I had to use this pedal if I was going to do anything with any of these breakbeats. It had only given me something like, I think it's 800 milliseconds. It's not even a second. And all I caught was that first, you know, downbeat and upbeat up to the first snare. Ding, ding, ding. And that's it, and it cuts off. So yeah, I just hit the pedal, and the first rhythm I did was literally this dum dum ding dum dum ding dum ding dum dum ding dum dum ding dum dum dum, to make up for, you know, the shortness of the sample, and to make up for the rest of the beats in the bar, because obviously with that sample you're only covering 1.5 beats, you know, of a four beat bar. So to make that up, obviously I had to keep re-triggering it when it ended. So in a way, the whole thing influenced me. I was influenced by the deficit of that pedal. And if it wasn't for the deficit of that pedal, and if that pedal would have enabled me to sample the whole bar of what I wanted to sample, a drum and bass may have existed, but it wouldn't have come from me. So that's why I'm quite happy to say that whilst I set out to create a new genre, and I was formulating, and I was looking at patterns, and I was trying to write to these patterns and to project ahead a little bit, thinking it would take me some time to get heard, to get signed and this and that, and I was trying to make up for that, this is what happened. And unfortunately, as I was thinking at the time, I couldn't sample what I wanted to sample, but I did get the first beat and a half, so I rehammered it. And then that's when I started hearing all of these different arrangements there and then, in that moment of what I'd just done. And I heard how everything I'd done could be reversed, and you could start the trigger on the snare. Ding, 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 ding. You see, and I was one of these guys that I think if I had an Akai sampler at the time, I probably would have sampled the whole thing, and I probably would have played it back, because that's what everyone else was doing, including myself, up till that time. We were all, the guys I was working with, and going right back to, I think, when I was 13 years old, there are many producers who were putting out, say, the Amen breakbeat, for example, using an Akai sampler. None of that led to drum and bass or even to jungle. Akai samplers have been around since the mid-80s, and I know because a lot of the people I was working with had one while I didn't. Nobody was chopping up or editing anything. People were using them as tape recorders and just going around and tape recording, and that's how they used to talk about it. Oh, let's take this, let's take that, and then put it in the track. Not sampling, which is different. It's an engineering, it's a process, it's an art. And it's a production. So nobody was doing any of this. And I was doing the same. I was using the Amen breakbeat in the late 80s. Messiah was using it, There Is No Law, in 1989, in an Akai sampler. No one was chopping this up. The Amen breakbeat is just one influence that led to push progressive hardcore into jungle and then into drum and bass over a four-year time span. That's it. Everyone had Akais throughout the 80s. No one was doing this. And in fact, when I started doing this, a couple of the guys that I was working with at the time that are now known and listed as pioneers of drum and bass actually laughed at me and took the piss because I was chopping up the drums. They actually took the picky. They were saying, we used to have this thing where I used to say to them, look, you're just lifting stuff and put it in your track. And I used to say to them, I believe, you know, when you say you're doing this as a respect thing, I think that's a bit of an excuse. You're just covering yourself and being lazy. And also, let's be honest, when you had a great breakbeat from the late 70s into a track like this, you know, this genre in the early 90s, of course it explodes. You know, you don't have to do anything. You know, a breakbeat just on top of a a bass drum and a snare drum with a hi-hat can just sound like a track if you roll it with a strong bass line. That's all you need to do. But there's no creation in that. And I'm all about creation, and I'm also all about desperation, hence having to optimize with everything I've always had. So when I've had a sampler and not had a drum box, obviously I've chopped up all my samples and I've separated them and re-triggered them. And I felt that that was the best way to compliment the artist, was to actually use what they've done as an influence and then answer it back with another creation and say, okay, well, this is what I'm going to do inspired by what you did there. So I just felt that, I actually felt I was being maybe a bit more honest. But leaving that aside, I get the other side of the argument that the other producers, they're doing it as a sign of respect. I get that and I accept that. I just see it slightly differently, and I'm just a lot more creative than that. And I, like I said, I never saw a sampler as a tape deck. So, you know, and this was happening in 1990, and between 1987 and 1991, I was laughed at for dissecting drums.
You know, when I first came across the Apache record, I was kind of amazed by it too, because you're right. It didn't exactly sound like the refined drum and bass you know from like Goldie or Ronnie Size. It was this kind of like you just said.
I'll be honest with you, I wish it had.
Yeah, it was through a guitar. It sounds like breaks or some kind of. And I'm interested in that like proto music. I have a fascination with Chicago house music and things prior before 91. I find that there was that golden era, especially in the English too, where it wasn't exactly. There were different names. You're calling it progressive hardcore. That's an interesting name. I mean, some people in the States, they won't say house. They'll say that there's an old time garage. It refers to the New York area. If you're down in Miami, they call it bass music, but everyone refers to it as Miami bass. It seems like there are these words just flying everywhere. Also, too, I like that. That one genre you've been recently messing with, a tech beat, on the Democratia album. That's interesting too, that you have people just trying to make up or at least throw genres as a way of a unique thing. We had on the show Brad Sinclair. Yeah, he has this thing called a hyper techno, which is his variant of like this very Japanese Enka style, but mixed with his hard Italio. It's interesting. It's interesting when you think about wordplay and genres like that.
That sounds interesting. For the one you mentioned there, Italo, sometimes some of the tracks we put out get classed on certain reseller sites as Italo. It's kind of funny, but we kind of get it. So that might be interesting. But if you don't mind, there was just something I was really curious to ask you about the Chicago sound. Were you ever into, again, it's another term that I think even the Americans stopped using, Jack. Like, if I was to say Steve Silk Hurley, does this name get you excited?
It's weird because some of the terms are pretty much from the African-American terminology. Jack is definitely one of them. A very popular club music that was in the past 10 years is Baltimore Club, or they call it B-more. Completely, entirely black genre of music. However, some have said it was the continuation of classical house, because you have to respect that most of the hip hop and house was an African American thing, and the B-more style was totally made in Fruity Loops, and it was like low tech and but it's kind of influential at the same time. It's just wasn't really talked about, and now today you have the commercialized electronic dance music or EDM or something, and it's kind of today everything is electronic now.
Hillier, would you say Alex's music is similar to digital hardcore, what you're into?
Oh, well, that's the...
Hey, I like that.
We were just thinking, too. I was about to say, one of my music I grew up with was Atari Teenage Riot's digital hardcore, where you were just referencing punk rock stuff, where, Atari Teenage Riot would just go all out, distorted, and it's just harsh. And that would help make breakcore and some of now what we have, 10 Tricks Point Never... with his, the creation of Vaporwave. It seems to me that this music, this drum and bass music, just got really harsh, and it's now just associated with anger. There was a period, you might see this of Ali G and the Chapsters, like this kind of English gangster, but then compared to the angry drum and bass style, it's weird, those two cultures.
Yeah, I think with drum and bass, I think when you're talking about the anger and aggression, I think obviously a lot of it's in the actual drum sounds, because there's a lot of obviously like liquid drum and bass, which a lot of people would probably say was quite the opposite to that, very laid back, very relaxing, chill out, which I love. My problem is every time I try and do a liquid drum and bass track, within four bars, I'm bringing in these big snare drums and kick-ass bass drums because I just can't handle it, and it just feels like things are missing. And I love liquid drum and bass, but I just can't do it. I try and I can't. I get somewhere and something starts taking off, and then within a few bars, it's another drum and bass track again, and it's kicking, and that's all I want it to do. I think maybe I just got to get a few things out of my system, then I might be able to work on stuff that's maybe a bit more relaxing and a bit more healthier all around for everyone and not just me.
Because what I got from the Delirious recording, it exactly wasn't drum and bass. It sounded like some breaks that, you know, you would get onto, and it certainly was very chill, and I kind of liked that music because I don't even think it was, jungle seems more of an appropriate word, but not even that. I kind of like that proto stuff on them. Like, for myself,
Oh, no, I was just going to sort of say that that's what we were trying to capture was in that album. We were trying to represent and show what was going on in this kind of core of EDM, if you like. And we wanted it to be a crossover album. So the first half of the album is more of that proto-hardcore sort of stuff. And then it starts slipping into and going over to what became jungle from the second half onwards. I think that's why the second half is probably a bit darker. I think the last track on the album, I think, is probably the darkest one there, with the School ED from New York, School ED breakbeats. This is what I mean. We were using it all. As soon as we hit upon that, we just started chopping everything up and really going for it. And the only sort of gear I had at the time, and even we didn't do a bass line. So all I was doing was bass lines and drums and sending those off to record companies. It wasn't really getting anywhere. And I was getting record companies saying to me, well, what is it? And I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, what do you mean, what is it? You asking me what it is means you should be signing it. Surely, how do you say to an artist, well, what is it? You know, and not even think about signing it. Surely, isn't that what every record company is after? A music that they're just like, wow, what is that? Whether they like it or not. But I had a lot of that at the time. It was very new. The BBC didn't take to drum and bass for 4 years. They were very anti it. They wanted to stay away from it. The major labels at the time were very anti it. They wanted to stay away from us because we were underground producers, and we went to all these illegal raves and we did this and we did that. And they just didn't want to touch it. It was only through pressure that came after the web. In around 94 that the mainstream media started realizing they had to start looking cool with the kids and getting into drum and bass. But the Apache thing, obviously a lot earlier, a couple of years earlier, was supposed to be a crossover. We really wanted to just try and capture what was going on in progressive hardcore and how it was moving through, speeding up, getting more chopped up, and then getting and sort of ending up more aggressive. And that was it. And I think at that time, all we had was an Emu sampler and an Alesis sequencer, and we have MIDI gate time problems, which you can still hear. Again, just hammering the gear we had and making the most of what we had.
Do you create all the animated visuals on your website? There's a lot of cool wacky vortexes and psychedelic colors.
You think that's cool? That's brilliant. Thank you very much. Yeah, I did. I'm not a graphic artist. Again, this is just more of the desperation that I was talking of, that I sort of work from having to optimize. I didn't at the time know a graphic designer to hook up with who I could collaborate with to do things like that with me. So I basically just wised up on some software, a few things, and created these standard animations. And I've got to say, I'm quite surprised because I did them in 1999 and I'm still using them. This is the first time I've ever given that away. So it's literally that. Is, you know, until I need to expand the collaboration, we need to involve video producers and people like that. But until then, just for the promos, I knocked these up back in the late 90s specifically to use just for promotional purposes for things like this. I had no idea I would be using them all these years later, but no one sort of complained, so I kind of felt that I got away with it. So I'll keep going for as long as I can, or until I can get a decent video producer. But thank you anyway. I just wanted to clarify, because I think you asked, I didn't do the artwork on the Apache cover. At the time, we were signed to a label called Big Music Productions in Bristol that took this on. They funded all of this, the manufacturing, the distribution, or some of the distribution. We did a lot of it ourselves on Sailor Return, literally going into record shops and setting things up. The record company paid for us to actually choose a cover. from some of the artists. I think it was a catalogue thing, and I think it was probably, I think it's the Daily Mail newspaper that owns the catalogue that wow. actual image came from. And at the time it was great, you know, it was a year after the Summer of Love, so there was still a bit of that kind of buzz around. I was still living just outside Bristol, it was all very summery and great, so it kind of made sense to sort of put it on there at the time. But yeah, that's a great picture, isn't it? It's great artwork from that artist.
Are you a fan of like vaporwave art?
What is that exactly? I've heard of the term, but I haven't looked into it, because this is relatively new, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's basically art made up on the internet through meme culture and through the music genre vaporwave, where you talk about anime and 1980s culture and 90s culture, and you put them in a very cyberpunk, purple kind of vivid way, and it flirts with this future based upon shopping malls and stuff like that. And so it's basically this very hip factor where things of the past of the 80s and 90s are loved, and they're formed to make a music genre. What's really popular is Macintosh Plus and the Floral Shop album. It seems to be a very but once again, the vaporwave really comes from a far, far, far future from drum and bass, digital hardcore, and today.
Sure. Sounds very interesting. I'm going to have to look more into that. But this is we're trying to get new material together at the moment. I find it very difficult. One of the things I find quite difficult to do is to stay up, stay involved, stay integrated into all the different communities and things, and create at the same time. It's still something I'm sort of trying to master.
How has your genre changed, and what do you see as some of the most recent trends in music?
Yeah, personally, I love the dubstep offshoot that came from drum and bass. It took me a few years to get into, because the initial dubstep that was coming out, obviously from the UK, the first dubstep tracks I heard were back in 2007. It was quite a long time ago, and they followed the same format for a few years, and nothing really changed. And I think there was a bit of sudden impact a few years ago, and dubstep just exploded, and the guys who work in it just started really pushing it and really expanding it. And I'm hearing actually more and more classical type influence structures now starting to appear in some types of dubstep and some of the dubstep related offshoots, but only recently. So dubstep, yeah, it didn't really do anything for me for the first few years, but yeah, over the last two or three years, there's particular tracks. I'm more into tracks with this genre than actual artists, generally speaking. But yeah, there's a few other things that I'm kind of looking to push myself within drum and bass. I want to revisit it. There's a couple of directions that were never really explored, like a harsher ambient thing. I think the Empathy track on the Delirious album might be closer to what I'm trying to describe at the moment. But yeah.
You have a philosophy page on your website that states your common philosophy about direct democracy and the nature of God. Can you explain more about your philosophy?
Oh, I'd love to, but please reel me in if I spin off on this one, because it's a bad habit of mine. So, yeah. The political side of things. Basically, I felt for a number of reasons that it was necessary for the establishment of a true democracy party anywhere in the West, but obviously in the UK. Separate to what led to that, I've always had my own sort of questions and things about God and religion. I see them as separate entities. And the whole thing about God, I guess, just to summarize it and not to start preaching or take anyone on a sermon, is basically my issue with the religious world is very simply this. I believe in God, no issue there. It's not something I've ever questioned was the existence of God. It's religion I have trouble with, and it's simply this. If, as the religion state, God created everything, therefore God can have no needs. Now, the implications of that, to me, are massive. It means that every religious book is off the mark. When anything can talk or list a need of a God that was self-sufficient before creating anything, then obviously it's left the plot, it's left the mark, it's off the mark. And so this is my issue. I've got no problem. I'm not anti-religious person. A lot of the people we work with are various religions, especially with the units I work with in Birmingham. I have a lot of Muslim friends and colleagues. My issue is with Islam, it's not with Muslims. My issue is with Christianity, it's not with Christians. My issue is with Catholicism, it's not with Catholics. do you see? And it's all based around this sentence, this, you know, if God created everything, then God cannot have any needs. If that's true, which I believe it is as a point of logic, then that means that therefore none of the religious books can possibly be telling anything of the truth about God, because they talk of a needy God with human requirements, this God that has dependencies on our thoughts and our behaviors. And, you know, it's us who are affected by our thoughts and our behaviors, not God. And, you know, just the fact that God, that we all acknowledge, people who believe in religion and or God, we all acknowledge that God existed before anything. Well, so from that point onwards, then we can't say, well, then God needs this of us. So that's really it's all about. The tie-in with politics is basically what I'm talking about here is free will. It's free will that we all have. It's free will that we experience and that we practice in every moment of our lives, whether we realize it or not. And all I'm talking about is with the politics. And all I'm saying is I believe that we need to put free will, majority free will, into law so that we can unite by taking over politics ourselves as people, that the people become no parties, no representatives. We all represent ourselves. We have true democracy, self-rule, because I don't see how else we're going to get unity. If you can't get social unity, you can't get stability, you can't get an economy, you can't get anything. So the first thing that any society must have is unity. If you can't get unity, you can't start building. And I just feel very strongly that this needs acknowledging, and that separately, the way to address that is with true democracy, is to keep the state, but remove parliament. So in the UK, we want to keep Whitehall. We want to keep the state. We've got no problem with the state. We have an issue with the government, with parliament, with so-called representatives, and fake democracy.
So basically abolishing the legislative branch of government and replacing that with the people.
Absolutely, yeah. In an approximate sense of saying it, yeah, we want to keep the current statute, keep the current laws. We want to do away with the politicians, and we want the people to be able to vote online on their own ideas, solutions and policies, and to actually decide. Because at the end of the day, what is the point in being born into a life if you're going to have no say over those life rules? That's slavery. And in my view, you're better off dead than being born into slavery.
Also, how it could be structured is people could vote all the time. So, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of voters who are ill-informed, and they're either some people are not intelligent, they lack the intelligence, or they're brainwashed by the media. But the most informed people would be the most active. So you would have this core group of people who are politically active, involved, and they would be involved in this direct democracy. I mean, I really like the I'm interested in the idea of voting online, but how do you prevent a voter fraud?
Well, from our perspective, and from an IT perspective, I've got quite a bit of IT experience with security and things like this. I myself personally wouldn't look out to do. I wouldn't look to do that. I would actually look like to work with that as an occurrence. So, for example, with my security systems in my office, we operate what's called a closed network. So everything that's sensitive or precious to us is not stored on an online system or a system that's connected to the net. We have one system as a terminal. So although we do run security on it and we try and prevent people from hacking, if they do, it doesn't matter. There's nothing on that system. So that's just an example of where in one of our offices where we put this into practice, where our ethic is, well, okay, let's not try and prevent hackers. Let's let them have this system with nothing on it. So, you know, that would be, it's an alternative approach, and I would be deploying an alternative approach. So, for example, voter safety and safeguards with digital voting, it would be, and to an extent, quite easy for me to sit here and pass off that we can do security that would do this and would stop that, but I wouldn't believe it. I don't think there's any 100% protection online. I don't believe there ever will be, because of the nature of people, not technology. So the only way that I could create, or that I could think of to create a counter for that. So, for example, if a policy was hacked, or if the whole country was voting on a policy one day, and a foreign state actor wanted to interfere with that to throw the vote, the best way to test it is offline, because in a world where everything sensitive is going online, the best security is going to be low tech, low key, and offline. So we've moved a lot of our systems offline already. We're kind of working ahead in this way. instead of basing things online and online servers, which is just ridiculous. For example, in the UK, the NHS National Health Service medical records for everybody in the country is stored on an online server. For the reasons they're doing that, there's no need. There is so much complacency by the decision makers, and they're making us all vulnerable. And we need to step up lawfully so that we can do something about it.
With the direct democracy party, the key issue is direct democracy. Do they
absolute
take stances
power, yeah,
on certain issues like, say, Brexit? And are they closer to the left or the right? Or they try to avoid those ideological issues?
Oh, it's interesting. We're not on the left-right spectrum at all, because with true democracy, you're removing parties and replacing them with the people. So as a party, the People's Administration, my true democracy party that I run, it can't be placed on the left-right spectrum because it doesn't have left-right ideals. It operates in a different sphere because it's all about people and individuals becoming a united community. And basically about what the people want. And about security, just what I was going to just add to the question before was, if the whole country's having a vote on something and then we need to check that vote, it's very easy to run offline sensors and surveys the next day to check. Because obviously, for example, if 75 people voted online one day to bring back hanging in the UK, for example, not something I'm up for, but it's just an example, okay, and then we went and checked that out on the street the next day, and only 10% of people on the street were saying that they would vote to bring back hanging, then obviously that would indicate that the system has been hacked. So we can use offline measures to check the online validity of the information that's being passed. And also, just one last thing with regards to security, everybody's nuclear power stations is connected to the internet. Like the power station that you're nearest to is connected to the internet. And I think that's far more dangerous than allowing people to talk, negotiate, and create solutions.
You also have the album, the newer album, Democratia, and you've also referenced that there's a political message behind it. How much has politics have been coming into your music, and do you wish more would be open to the ideals of the direct democracy? Do you think music, because you said before that you write a story and then it goes along with music as well.
Yeah, that's right. I want to be doing a lot more of this with the music, in the sense I can't help it. I almost don't have the choice. It is so within me at the moment, because I think just because of how important I feel it is, to the point where I don't actually want any involvement in politics whatsoever. I almost hate the work that I do every day on politics and on this issue and on democracy. I just want to write music. But I really felt that the need for a true democracy party, and no one else is going anywhere near setting one up. That's why. But that said, of course, I want to use the music as a political vehicle, but I need to be working with more vocalists, which we're looking to do at the moment. And I'm hooking up with some guys from Syracuse, just outside New York City. John Carter, Lil Juice, Young Nate, West Rock Crew, and who are a hip hop outfit. And we're looking at doing some, we're talking at the moment about doing some drum and bass remixes of some of their latest material. And they're quite political. And so this is how we're trying to use the music to try and get through to people. But the trouble is, of course, in the UK, the People's Administration has a massive problem with the mainstream media. They absolutely hate everything we represent. And within 2 months of setting up the party in 2010, we spoke with them. They told us to our faces they weren't having any of it and they didn't want the people to know about it. And that was over 6 years ago. You know, so we've actually been told by the mainstream media in the UK, like, go away. And of course, I've also had my own experience of working voluntarily with various prime ministers and ambassadors from different governments from all over the world on various issues over the last few, well, going right back to 2001. I've got experience of working with these people, obviously voluntary. I wouldn't work with these people. I did this for my own experience and my own insight. I decided in 1989 that if I ever got the opportunity to lawfully infiltrate a UK government, then I would. And it came along in 2008 when I was a manager at a community centre in Birmingham, and I met David Cameron about a year and a half before he was elected. And he wanted me to stay in touch, so I did. And obviously, like I said, I'm not into politics. I hate politicians and the whole thing that's going on. I love just true democracy and people organising their free will together and unity. But it's too serious, you know, because me switching off from politics just because I don't like it is not going to stop the threat of politics coming to me. And this is what I wish other people would realize. Just because they're not interested in politics doesn't mean politics isn't interested in them. And as far as the way I see it, we've elected wolves. Yeah, these aren't people. These people are ill. And even if they're not ill, at the best of times, they're incapable, they're unqualified, they're fools, their agendas take them away, their lobbyists take them away. They're not solution creators. And the UK, I feel personally, the UK people have absolutely let themselves become deluded into thinking that the purpose of politicians is to create solutions. It's not. It never was. The purpose of politicians is to create and implement laws. That's it. That's control. It's got nothing to do with creating social solutions for anybody. And also, of course, a lot of people don't know what democracy means. They don't know what it means. They just got no idea that it means rule of the people, that's what it literally means. Because obviously, once you understand that democracy means rule of the people, well, then you see that the phrase representative democracy is a dichotomy. It doesn't work. You either have a representative or you represent yourself. And if I'm wrong, then in the UK and in America and all across Europe, in these so-called democracies, well, in that case, then, where is the self-rule aspect? Where is the rule of the people aspect within these representative so-called democracies? Because I don't see any, and that's been the problem. These guys knew about the effects of CO2 releases on the atmosphere since 1846. That's when they were first advised about it. In the UK, every 4 to 5 years, they just pass the buck from one government to another, and it's the people who have suffered, because politicians only have to be responsible for 4 or 5 years. With somebody only has to be responsible for 4 or 5 years, where's their motive to create a lifelong solution for any issue for anybody? I don't see it, and there isn't one. So every 4 years, they just come in, they come out, and they tell the people, oh, we failed to listen. What, they went deaf, did they? No, politicians aren't deaf. They never go deaf, and the people know that. The people are being stupid. They're deluding themselves. They need to wake up before they get crushed by what I believe is the most dangerous political senate in this country, and that is the UK Parliament. And I say that because it's still got, I believe, a 90% influence on all of the world's other parliaments and senates. And we saw that in 2013 when David Cameron wanted to take England and the UK into Syria, to bomb Syria. We saw that vote fold in the British Parliament. And then one by one, over the next 3 days, every European country that was suddenly all very gung-ho and wanted to go with America to beat up Assad and co, all suddenly pulled out and didn't want to know. It's just an example. And I believe, I mean, from my own direct experience of working with these governments, as an activist, I believe I've seen too much to not do anything about. And to the point where if I don't, then I'm a traitor.
Do you think Brexit weakened the power of the UK Parliament, or they're still just as dangerous as they were prior to Brexit?
You know, English culture, it's got this spite element to it. It's probably a bit of both. If they are about to be crushed or pulled apart, they're probably even more dangerous from what I know of British politicians. They're at their worst when they're pushed into a corner, when they think they've got nothing to lose. They're going to strike and take you down with them.
They're still in NATO.
Yeah, that's true. That's another crazy thing. Now, don't get me wrong, I am not coming from the same orientation as Donald Trump on anything, but particularly NATO. I don't agree with NATO. I don't think that anyone should be involved in NATO, but it's not for the reasons of Donald Trump. It's not to do with finance. It's because it's very simple. Why should a whole group of countries go and involve themselves in a war that a third party started with another country without conditions? What is this about? This whole pact where all these countries have said to each other, right, if one of you gets attacked or starts a war with someone else, we're all in with you, regardless of how or why. Surely that's the fastest way to World War III. Surely.
Extremely dangerous. I remember there was that incident where Turkey shot down a Russian plane, and if something happened between, say, Turkey and Russia, then that would... under the UN, the NATO resolution, I think it's NATO resolution 5, that would force NATO into war with Russia, so it's extremely dangerous.
Well, a few years ago, I was working with the Palestinian Authority and directly on the Middle East issues, the Middle East peace process and the issues there between Palestine and Israel. And I worked with them loosely for two, three years maybe. Then I found myself getting involved with various governments over the Syrian issue. My work with the Syrian issue is confidential, so I can't divulge anything really about about what my input was and who I was working with, other than say that the issue that you just mentioned, the event you've just mentioned, is probably the best example. There's, in my own personal view, there was at least three potential triggers for World War III going on in Syria between 2015 and 2016, and that was one of the major ones. Thankfully, just my own personal view, Putin isn't reactory. He's not a reactivist like us. He's going to be measured and he's going to be calm, and thank God. Because it's just what you've said. Turkey was actually, in my belief, was looking to pull NATO into a war against Russia and didn't care about ISIS. In my belief, Turkey was funding ISIS at that point, along with Saudi Arabia. So, your example is more accurate than even you realize. And that's pretty much all I can say at the time, at this time, about that incident. But yeah.
What do you see in the future right now of electronic music genres? Is because right now everything seems to be internet based, and music genres like vaporwave have came from internet popular culture, and that, you know, programs like Reason or Fruity Loops, where you just have the program on your computer, it's less about hardware now and everything seems to be digital. People are now rampantly sharing music through SoundCloud and other things, and so music creation is definitely going somewhere in electronic music. And as for dance music, it seems like it's in a post-dubstep EDM state at the current moment.
Yeah.
So yeah. I just feel like, what's like really big in like your area right now? Or what do you see like the future for dance music?
Okay, in my own maybe quite negative opinion, I'm going to just answer that fact and say nothing. And the reason why I'm saying that is because I've seen, when it comes to genres and dance cultures and subcultures, I've seen the same thing throughout my life. I've seen that basically is this. A handful of people create stuff. Everyone else latches onto it, copies it, mimics it. Fine, that's brilliant. That's what launches a genre. That's what gets a city rocking and all the rest of it. But my point is this. Out of those people, that biggest group of people, no one seems to want to experiment and play with it. And that's where you get your so-called evolutions and where you get your new genres from, is by people pushing the frontiers of anything, but particularly of a music. But I think some of the mechanisms you've just mentioned are going to be brilliant for future electronic music, because one of the things that they're doing that bits of software don't do is it's pulling in people that aren't musicians. It's making musicians out of people that might not have normally found that within themselves. So one thing I feel quite excited about, some of the digital and the web mechanisms you've mentioned, is that a lot of people out there that might be lost, not knowing what they're up to, whatever, because it's very easy to get sucked into music. So it's going to reach a lot of people that basically have music in them, but don't know that yet. And it's going to be the doorway for them, these kind of mechanisms. And it's just going to bring them right in. On a second aspect regarding to what I was saying first about music being recycled, copied, duplicated, and then pushed, I think that things only go around in circles for so long, and that staleness itself is what creates the opportunity for new genres. It's like how with any financial bubble, there's also a positive. You need your bubble to burst before you can have your economy going up, and obviously you need it to crash again to reset. It's all part of a longer balance, a longer-term balance. I see it as similar patterns within music. When a new genre comes out, something that gets people comes out, other people latch on. And incidentally, just regarding the drum and bass earlier, everyone who I knew who had an Akai before I did, immediately after 1991, summer of 91, started chopping up all the drums and everything with that Akai that they always had, which wouldn't have happened. This is what I was saying. It all comes back to that pedal for me, that moment, the Roland delay sampler pedal. If it had enough memory for me to do what I wanted to do, I wouldn't have created anything new in that moment.
You were talking about political issues. You've also talked a lot about environmental issues, global warming, and alternative fuels.
Yeah. Oh, alternative fuels. Like I say, if I just go off, just reel me in, okay? We're working on some ideas at the moment where we're experimenting that's looking quite exciting. Alternative fuels, for one thing, the alternative fuels have always been around. Henry Ford was using hemp, cannabis, marijuana in the plastics in his cars in 1939. Henry Ford invented a hemp polymer. So ever since Henry Ford did that, there's been no reason for any manufacturer anywhere in the world to use crude oil in their plastics for anything. It didn't need to be in cars, it doesn't need to be in clothing, it doesn't need to be in anything. Or everything that you can see around you, wherever you are right now, that consists of plastic, could have been made with hemp instead of crude oil. Henry Ford's range of cars were actually banned by the American government in 1941, put out of commission. He built a whole range. It wasn't just a car, a prototype. He had a whole range of cars he wanted to mass produce in Germany and in America. The plastic was made of a hemp polymer, and they ran on hemp. They ran on hemp and water, hemp seed oil and water. So, you know, the alternative solutions are the solutions that have always been provided to us by this planet before we even got here anyway. We've just abused them for monetization, for systems, you know, for energy systems where that we can monetize. In my view, we never needed oil, and we certainly don't need nuclear energy either. There's a lot of missed electricity formats. Tesla. That's all I can say. Tesla was onto something. Ford was onto something. Tesla was pulling electricity out of soil, out of air. In vast amounts, scalable amounts. If Tesla wasn't murdered, cities now, today, could be fueled by his devices. Just one of his devices could run a whole city. So the energies we're using at the moment, in my view, they're all fake. It's all about monetization. It's not about energy supply. It certainly isn't about sustainability, because there's nothing in our so-called civilized life at the moment that is sustainable.
Yeah. What do you have? What's your plans for the future of your music? And do you continue to make drum and bass, or are you going to go back to tech beat? Are you just going to try to make out there new music, or do you see also re-releasing the very Apache on or Delirious on a 12-inch or maybe something like that?
You know, that's really interesting that you ask that, because there's a couple of tracks I wouldn't mind redoing. I think particularly the Empathy one, because the Empathy track in that is really, I think out of all the tracks on that album, the one that's closer to me. And I think that's the one where I pretty much wrote that, except for the bass line. I put all that together, that track. I want to do more stuff like that. But I want to leave the tech beat alone for a little while, because Demokratia, there was an experimental hybrid which we created with hip-hop, trance and techno. And I'm quite excited about that, and I think other people could be if I got behind it and pushed it a bit more. So I want to be doing a lot more of that. I do want to look at the tech beat and exploring more of that. But key at the moment is actually drum and bass and hip-hop. And I think the thing I love doing the most, I think at the moment, probably more than writing at the moment, I love remixing other people's music into drum and bass, like these guys I was talking about earlier from West Rock. John Carter, Young Nate, Lil Juice. I love these guys, hip hop and the rap, the material, everything about them. And I'm looking to, if I could just spend the next year remixing the hip hop tracks these guys put out, I'd be in almost heaven. You know, if that's all I was doing, I'd be in heaven. I love remixing. I would love to get into remixing. And also, it would take some of the pressure off. You're not writing so much when you remix, other than the parts that you're replacing. So I think a bit more of everything, and also something that I've done that I've restricted my output all my musical life ever since I was 13, 14, 15 when I started and looking at music, started writing music. Well, I started when I was 9, but when I started thinking about doing it commercially at 13, 14, 15, one of the things where I've really suffered and really gone wrong in my career is by trying to keep myself within the genres that I'm sort of closest to, because a lot of the time when I get a track or something, there's always a track going on in your head. All you can do is change it or write about it or whatever. You can't turn it off. I basically want to keep exploring that stuff, bring the stuff out, the classical stuff, do the drum bass remixes, and a lot more of the hip-hop / trance hybrid that we came out with from the guys in London, the rappers in London. A lot more of that. Less politics. Yeah.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Alex Romaine for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Well, thank you. It's been a really enjoyable interview, and it was really, really nice chatting with you guys. It was very, very interesting.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you, Alex.
Pilliter, thank you very much, both of you, and to you too, Robert.